my chances are so much higher to fight for what's better. But we don't do that because we become capitalists. We say, well, you know what? I got this house. I got this TV. I got this car. I'm okay. I have a partner. I like them. I'm just not going to go down this road. I'm okay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things that they always say about climate change is that they gave us too much of a heads up, I guess, in a sense. Like it wasn't alert. It wasn't alarmist enough. It's like, oh, in 30 years, it's a problem.
Right. Yeah. And so and that's what happens, right? When they say in 30 years, it's a problem, we wait until we're walking on lava to say, okay, this burns.
All right. Hi, and welcome to the Skeptical Leftist Podcast, the show where I talk to a variety of people to spread progressive politics, left-wing philosophy, and critical thinking. So you can tell my brain's not a fully on right now because I couldn't remember the last part. But and today I'm joined by Ali. I apologize. Your last name is Horiat?
Perfect. See, okay. Got it on the first go. So you're all there. Don't worry.
Yes. And you are the, I guess, the creator and I guess, president or runner of Compassivist Publishing.
You also got that right. Yes. Well, Compassivist Publishing is part of the Compassivist Octopus, which holds the foundation and the movement and the art program and the music program. We've got eight tentacles essentially attached to the body, which is the society, the movement, and which runs through the foundation and out into the arms where Compassivist Publishing is one of. Yes.
Okay. Very cool. So I guess that's kind of just the basics, but kind of what's your story in a sense? Anything you want people to know about you?
Anything I want people to know. No, I want people to know about the movement, not about me. But how the movement started was I used to be in the finance world. So I used to be pretty successful in the finance world. And one day I quit. And I quit and I decided to change my life around. It was just not the happiness that I was anticipating. And I realized I was addicted. I was addicted to money. And it's something not a lot of people understand. You know, you can be addicted to drugs. You can be addicted to many different things, but not generally. People don't say I'm addicted to money. But I felt, I realized that I was. And I realized that the stories that people were sharing with me from rehab and all the other things that they've gone through to restructure their lives was resonating so much with everything I was going through with money. And so I realized, wow, you know, there's a case there. And so I took 5 years, traveled and, you know, lived among different people, different environments all around, and came up with the idea of Compassivist and the term. Essentially, I realized to make a difference and to have a better world, you need to be involved. You can't sit back and expect things to just happen or work. And you can't sit back and expect the person who is paid to work at that space to make things better to be the catalyst of it and you just enjoy the benefits. So, And where change comes from is essentially compassion. You need to feel something about, you know, you need to have that passion to start with. And because the world today is in this destructive manner that it is really, you need to have compassion, whether it's for animals, or whether it's for the situation of the planet environmentally, whether it's for people, the inequality gaps, you know, the oppressions, the security problems we're facing, the refugee problems we're facing, all of these things. So you need to have compassion. And that compassion can only make a difference if it's activated. If, you know, if me and you speak for the next 6 years and do nothing about all our ideas, even if our ideas are the most genial ideas in the world, nothing's going to happen and nothing's going to change. We could be Socrates and Plato sitting here talking, but if we only speak for the next 6 years, the world will deteriorate. We will be extinct while we're having this conversation. So it's really fiddling while Rome burns when you just speak. But when you act, it becomes the change. And so I believe compassivist is a, you know, a joined word, meaning the compassionate activist. And so I started the movement based on that, based on taking our politics, taking our spiritual understanding of what betterment is, and using compassion as the guide to every action we take. So instead of thinking, this is profitable, we should do this. No, this is going to make the world better because we look at things from a compassion perspective.
Right. No, I can understand that. That's interesting. I'm so when you were talking, I was thinking like, it's kind of like our whole society, all of the world is addicted to money.
Essentially, yes. Essentially, yes. I mean, when you talk about the addiction to money, I mean, the reason we're in the mess we're in today is because we took capitalism out of context. You know, a lot of people find fault in the concept of capitalism and they blame capitalism, so to speak. And it's used in the discussions as, you know, this negative connotation with the identification of the word, the meaning of the word. But if you go back and you look at the origins of capitalism, it wasn't to build empire. It wasn't to be a billionaire. It was none of that. It was just to give people enough resources so that as they competitively push each other to bring out the best solutions for the common good of the world, they are being funded, so to speak, or they've been, you know, provided the resources to be able to do that. So if you have, you know, Einstein in a lab where you give Einstein all of the needs, if you have Marie Curie in the lab and you give her all of her needs, they're going to come up with these beautiful things that are going to advance us, right? Mm-hmm. You give Apple the money that Apple needed to become Apple, they give you all the tech you have today. So
right
now,
which is actually what happened, right?
Exactly, which is exactly what happened. And that kind of capitalism to drive betterment for the universe is good. But what happened is people started noticing that, hey, in my capitalism, there's opportunism. So there's, you know, opportunity involved. And the opportunity is valued through money, through currency. And so if I now stop thinking of, you know, how I can make the most sustainable, t-shirt in my neighborhood and sell it in my neighborhood, I can now go to China or Vietnam or other places and India and induce slave labor and do all of these things that will make that t-shirt, you know, cost the less amount possible. So really, slavery was a part of that. You know, we brought in a labor force to North America that would essentially put a number, you know, minimal for the cost of labor because you didn't have minimum wage. You didn't have any of those things. So what happened? My profit became higher. So it all became a matter of profitization. And because we went into that profit understanding of capitalism, we destroyed capitalism. And how did that happen? By the addiction to profit, right? The addiction to money caused the destruction of capitalism. So it's kind of like, you know, you have a beer once a month at a game or something. It's not going to kill you. It'll probably never kill you. But if you have that beer once a month now, once a week, and slowly, like, oh, this is really good, I'm going to have it daily. And then, you know what? I love being drunk. I'm going to have it every minute. Then you're going to shift the beer at the game once a month to being an alcoholic. And that's where the problem comes. So that's what happened. There was no control mechanism, so to speak, to deter us. And so now we're at this place where we're addicted to money and we destroy everything. Just like having, you know, if you have a cousin who's addicted to, any disastrous hard drug, you know, and you allow them in your house, you're going to have to deal with your TV missing one day and all these things happening. So it's the same thing here. We're just destroying ourselves.
Yeah. So I guess we kind of covered your political ideology. You said it's compassivist. And So I guess, and you also kind of described it, but how do you manifest that within your actual like day-to-day life?
So day-to-day life on two levels. One is on the personal level, which is basically your lifestyle. And again, this is controversial in a way because I'm a vegan, but when people ask me, what is a vegan? I tell them it's not that It's not about not eating animals. It's not about, the avocado toast situation, because that itself is so destructive, right? You gotta watch where your food is coming from. Veganism is a protest lifestyle, is an activist lifestyle. So when I don't buy leather shoes and I buy, say synthetic leather shoes, I have to think, wait, what is this synthetic leather made of? How much oils are in there? What process of production is that? Because if I care about the animals in the jungle or in the forests, and this non-leather shoe, this synthetic leather shoe, is destroying more trees, more ecosystem, more habitat, what is the point of being vegan? I might as well just eat that one cow that is less destructive than killing a whole forest because of my supposed activism, because it's an uneducated activism. So on the personal side of my life, it's about education. So compassion comes in through education, because I educate myself as much as I can to every consumption that I have. So everything is mindful, which is driven through this, gateway of using compassion as the way you think about everything. So really, if you want to think about it on a broader level, is the Jesus mentality, try to love everyone and try to do everything out of the gates of love, as opposed to any other ideology. Now, on the other side of it, again, education plays a really big role in compassivist mentality. And that is in your work, in your business, in your dealings with people, everywhere outside of that personal space, you have to essentially know that you cannot just take decisions and choices and measures that affect the profit margin or the profit line of the work that you're doing or whatever you're involved with. And this goes not just to entrepreneurs, because people generally attack them or the 1% or that kind of mentality, but it also goes to everybody, in the sense that an artist today will say, my expressionist opinion of stuff is going to be about a certain thing. But what I'm going to do, because it pays well, is I'm going to live in New York and paint people's dogs on portraits. And that's going to go in a gallery, because that's kind of what is trending right now. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do the trending thing because it'll pay the bills. And I'm not going to do what I believe in. And so, you're not going to have Picassos anymore, because right, they weren't doing the trending thing. And so the hypocrisy, walking away from hypocrisy, using compassivist mentality to be honest with yourself, to be honest with your dealings, to be honest with your views and how it impacts the world. From the gallery owner who says, no, I'm not going to be part of the trend. I'm going to allow artists their own voice to discuss and showcase the social issues that they're dealing with and they want to reflect. And the artist who says, thank you for providing this space. I'm going to now be an advocate and stand with you. And here's my painting that goes into that space. So it's a communal vision of a collective working to a better future.
That's interesting. I think when it comes to, like, if we're talking about artists, often artists, when they do that stuff to like pay the bills, they don't really have any real other choice, right? Because of the dynamics of our society. So it's always, it's a tough position to be in when you're creating things that aren't selling, because that's not what's trendy or popular.
Mm-hmm. But that's where the community comes in, right? That's where the collective comes in. So if the collective was going to say, no, we're not going to give into the trend issue, or we're not going to give into, what is essentially, moving through powerful media and influencers and stuff, but we're going to allow people their natural voices, then you will have this, beautiful symphony of voices coming out from all sides. And there is a lot more ability to then have a democracy, because when you allow that freedom of expression, essentially, you allow people to feel comfortable to express rather peacefully. But when you trend and you have a mainstream, it means everybody who falls off of that mainstream is now not selling. So there's a lot of friction. And in a place, for example, like the United States, where the elections are, 49.5 to 50.5, it means half of the country is essentially not in the mainstream. It's no longer 10% were, off. Let's just push them out to the West. Let's just put them in California or somewhere. No, it's half of the country is essentially off. So what are you going to do? So that becomes the problem of not allowing people that?
It's tough because the way that things have been set up, right? Like, because the people who own the media, the people who decide who's trending or what's trendy, they only have, you know, they don't want to allow outside voices, or they don't want to allow anything that's not profitable for them.
There you go. So that's again the addiction to money going through media. Going every place has that. The, you know, auto industry will have it. The aviation industry, tourism, every, you know, industry you look at is based on this addiction to profit. So, you know, in that concept, you kind of kick away everything that is valuable for the purpose of everything that is most profiting.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm really into the idea of the collective and like community decision-making and communities working together for the betterment of the community and whatnot. But it seems like I do my share of propaganda. I try to promote stuff, but yeah, it's tough to get a voice. Like, I guess my local reading group was just reading Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky his co-author. And, like the power that is the owning class or the people who have the most money and that stop us from actually having a voice larger than that. It's quite daunting, I guess.
Right. But you also have to look at it from the perspective that we are the people who allow that voice to exist. I mean, if I'm not buying and if I'm not working in the trending, then I'm one person. I will be unsuccessful. But if myself, Corey, and Corey's reading group and everybody we know and everybody that they know and everybody that they know, that becomes the whole world. So, you know, it's the same issue as going back, you know, in thousands of years in slavery. I mean, the people of Egypt could have rebelled against Pharaoh if it was, you know, the ability of a collective to think about coming together and doing that. But they never did because the fear of each person individually rebelling is suppressed by the power that they're rebelling against. Because they people, you know, our minds are not connected in that way. My mind and your mind are not, you know, connected in this sci-fi way of some of the alien civilizations we have in sci-fi that are connected into one mind, right?
Right.
But if we were able to connect into that one mind, then collectively, there's no force greater than the masses, which is why revolutions happen.
And in fact, the Egyptian workers did revolt when they didn't give them their food and their beer.
And that's what happened, right? So eventually the revolution happened. Eventually, you know, the Pharaoh left. And every revolution's like that. Eventually you get to a point where, you know, dying today with the chance of possibly not dying and succeeding and getting food versus dying tomorrow for sure puts you in a predicament. Well, you know what? I have no tomorrow, so I might as well. And that mentality should come so much earlier. It should come at a point where I have a little bit of resources. Now, my chances are so much higher to fight for what's better. But we don't do that because we become capitalists. We say, well, you know what? I got this house. I got this TV. I got this car. I'm okay. You know, I have a partner. I like them. I'm just not going to go down this road. I'm okay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things that they always say about climate change is that they gave us too much of a heads up, I guess, in a sense. Like it wasn't alert. It wasn't alarmist enough. It's like, oh, in 30 years, it's a problem.
Right. Yeah. And so and that's what happens, right? When they say in 30 years, it's a problem, we wait until we're walking on lava to say, okay, this burns. I need to do something about it.
Oh, but, dang. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, exactly. But right now I'm walking on concrete that's still cold. Let me figure out how I can maintain this. No, that's not an issue because it's not prioritized because right now I need to chase money.
Right. Yeah. The economy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why everything becomes secondary.
So I haven't really heard of Compassive East before. So have you had much luck getting this out into the world, your viewpoint?
We've had luck getting it out into the world. The idea behind Compassive East is not to have a... See, the thing is, when you ask a question like that, it essentially means if Ali Horiat has 100 million followers, then Compassivista is successful, because that's the measure that we go by, right? Wow. I mean,
sort of, yeah. I mean, that's not necessarily what I mean, but yeah.
No. But I'm just saying that's how we look at things. But if you think about, for example, Karl Marx, right? The communist movement, essentially, Russia, you know, USSR, all these other revolutions and everything that happened, and the Eastern European bloc and other places in the world that took on this China, Cuba, different versions of this, they essentially worked from his political perspective, which is a social perspective before political, which is a humanitarian perspective before social, even. So it's not really political. It's a social order restructuring. And they looked at that and they took it up. But never was he a president or a prime minister or anything like that. You know, he died well before any of this could happen. And even if it did, he wasn't placing himself in a position of, I'm going to be the leader of the movement and I want to take the world over, right?
Yeah.
So in that sense, Compassivista is not about follow Ali Horiat. It's about let that concept of Compassivista simmer within you. And so you become a Compassivista as a person when you understand that the way to change is for yourself and your collective that you can influence be able to make that change. So I recently found out that there are people in Brazil who have a Compassivista branch out there, and they're supporting, it's a bunch of lawyers who are supporting women who are going through domestic violence, and they're doing pro bono work for them, and they're helping, you know, hundreds of women a month. And so from Compassivista Foundation, we decided to support them and connect with them and to essentially raise funding for them so they can help more people. And really, you know, that kind of coming together, a decentralized version, means that now you have that Greek democracy where, take away the bad parts of it, of course, but keeping the good things of the Greek democracy, which is the mainstream idea of Greek democracy, where everybody has a vote, which was not
true. The rule by demos, right?
That was the idea, right? The idealistic version of it. That's the way we want to be. We want to be that idealistic version of the Greek democracy where everybody really has a say. Everybody has an input. When you have an input, you're having a say. So do we have success? Yes, because I've heard of Compassivista from Australia to Alaska. But does Ali Horiat have success in being famous and, you know, having celebrities take pictures with him? No, Ali's not, celebrated in that way.
So, right. Yeah, it's like, I find that if it's the ideas that are getting spread, like I promote my version of what is anarchism, right? Like, which seems pretty compatible with your Compassivista perspective. And so when I see people that I don't, that I didn't tell about anarchism talking about it, I get excited because it's about the ideas. It's not about what I'm doing. It's about
naturally.
Yeah,
naturally.
So it's good.
Yeah.
So I guess, have you encountered pushback from anti-Compassivista people?
Yes. And you know what's funny is, sad funny, is that I've encountered this push more from people who are supposed to support as opposed to the people that you're expecting to push back. So when I talk about environmental issues or when I talk about, for example, we had this campaign about ethical banking. If you're really going out there and protesting things, the first thing you should do is watch where your money's going. Because if you're banking with, HSBC, for example, which funds the most fossil fuel projects in the world at this point, when you're putting your money in there, even if it's an account with $50, you're another subscriber into that system.
Yeah.
Educate yourself. Look at that bank down the street and say, hey, they're a green bank, or, they're doing this and that, or they have certain policies and mandates. Even if they're hypocritical about it, that's fine. At least they are trying, at some point. But when a bank comes blatantly and says, hey, we're in the fossil fuel business, that's where it is, we don't care about the environment, you putting your money in there is a problem. So, at that point, I feel like that's where it boils from. So, you have to do that. You have to make that pledge with yourself to adjust your corners first. And then, you know, you go from there. So I was expecting people from these far places like HSBC, not necessarily HSBC, but, you know, that area to come back and fight me, or, you know, the far right to come out and fight me and stuff. But it wasn't. It was never like that. It was more the capitalists within, you know, our own community who are like, hey, right, this is dangerous because, yeah, this person is going to ruin my capitalism within this space. So there are people out there who are saying, oh, come put your money in our fund because we only, invest in green tech, and we're on the NASDAQ, and we're the first company on NASDAQ to be a green only fund and blah, blah, blah. And I say to them, why are you on NASDAQ? Because they also have all the fuel company, oil companies and the energy companies and all the bad guys. So you're essentially giving them profit by existing on that platform. And why don't you then, you know, say we refuse to be on the platform where it promotes A, B, and C that are bad? Oh, no, you know, well, you have to play in that space. So Compassive is publishing. I'll give you an example. We only do online digital books. We don't do print. And right, you know, that's because regardless of the sustainability of print, this is a fact. 89% of any piece of paper that you touch is illegally logged.
Oh, interesting.
And every book that's bound anywhere in the world will have an aspect of slave labor in some definition of it. Whether because you don't know the source of the
really
glue, you don't know the
source. Actually. Yeah.
Right. And so because of that, I can't print a book and ensure whether it's the glue for the binding or the staple or whatever it is, or the paper itself is 100% ethical. So I said, guys, my authors, you want to come on board, but we're ethical as much as we can be because we're not taking profit into account. We're losing about 70% of the sales share because, you know, they're still paper books, but we're trying to make a difference. And when we're doing this political stance where we're saying, this is why, fix the illegal logging, fix the child labor, and we'll gladly print publish. But until that is an issue, we're going to protest. So then come the people who say, oh, you know, we don't want to be, we're writing about sustainability, but we don't want to be in your program, in your publishing house, because, you know, Random House Publishing is giving us a deal with marketing where I get to travel all around the US on a chartered flight, promoting my book and doing readings at bookstores and signing and things like that. And they publish 1 million print copies and they've promised me a bestseller position, spending millions of dollars because that's what gets you a bestseller. So,
right.
And you're writing about sustainability. How are you writing about sustainability and doing this marketing spiel? It's full hypocrisy. So I get challenged more from capitalists within the industry that are supposed to be the people changing the world than I do from the people who are flat out honest. They're like, look, I don't care about the environment. I'm working towards my Porsche. You know, I have a fund. I'm trying to raise money to buy that Porsche. I really don't care about you, your activism, the environment. I like that person because you're honest. You're standing in front of me. You're saying, look, this is my position. I have a right to this position until it's illegal in society. It may be immoral, but it's legal. But the other person is coming around to me and saying, I'm going to be a hypocrite.
I'm on your
morality.
Side, but.
Yeah, I'm going to be a hypocrite of morality. So I'm really destroying your morality because I'm teaching people within the morality sector how to be immoral under the label of morality. So it's kind of like the way the food industry is cheating the food labels, the nutrition labels, right?
Yeah.
That is worse. That is much worse than the people who come out and say, look, I'm selling you poison, but it tastes really good. So if you're crazy, have it. That's cigarettes. You know, they come out, they tell you, I'm selling you poison. If you want to kill yourself with, go ahead. Go ahead, be my guest. You know, here's a bottle of vodka. Go ahead. You know what it is. I'd rather that than a guy who's saying, this is orange juice. It's really good for you. Drink it every day. Drink 2 glasses every day. But then you become a diabetic.
Yeah, I can understand that. It's. I think there might be some nuance to that, right? Like there's degrees to which, because, I mean, there's unethical practices within the production of computers and tablets and phones that are also reading digital books and whatnot. And like, so it's not like you can get away from it entirely, but you can nuance, you can you know, measure, have a more measured way of doing things.
What you just said there is also something that I find happens because of the way our media, you know, makes its way into our minds. So when people say to me, but you know what, Ali, to the digital book, you still have to buy an e-reader to read it. I say, why? Why do you have to buy an e-reader to read it? Or an e-book thing or whatever. And why? Don't you have a laptop? I mean, you're just talking to me on something. I mean, it's working. Yeah. It's functional.
Read it on there. I don't need a new device.
Right. Exactly. That's where it is. So the industry comes out, the paper industry came out, and they said, guys, we need to get some scientists on board. We need to pay them a lot of money. We need to put out some, you know, a report about how ebooks are disastrous for sustainability and the environment, because, you know, we're starting to lose. We've lost 30% of the market to e-readers, because before there was no such thing as digital books. We had 100%. Now it's 30%. Not only are we involved in it because they're doing it, I mean, all of the guys who are printing are also selling in digital, but also we need to make sure that we keep our print because there's more profit there. That's the catch. Right, there's more profit there. So we need to put these reports out. But I say, hey, you have most people have a smartphone today. Most people who are going to read your book have a smartphone, right? Use that. So when you start telling me that new device, I start saying, no. And then come, you know, the people who are making those devices to say, you need an e-reader. You need this with the anti-glare and all these other things, because, you know, when the sun's hitting, you can't read on your phone and, you know, God forbid. So you need to carry five different pieces of equipment just to buy this extra digital book.
Yeah, it's funny. I read a lot of digital books and I read a lot of print books. So it's like, I have no problem with digital books at any stretch, and also you can often keep the cost down that way too, because so then the consumer can access it easier, even if they don't have the money to buy a print book.
And also the issue with the print books is, you know, there isn't a big marketplace for sharing your books. I mean, you have all these books, you know, in the shelf behind you, and, how often do these books circulate? How often do they come out and they go around your city, even, you know, for people to have access to? Because you read the book once, you're not going to read it every other week. You know, you may read a book twice if it's really interesting, but not five times. So after you've made that once or twice, can you not share it with your community? And then people say, oh, but what about the author and, you know, the sales and the rights and all those things? And I said, well, that's what it's about. That whole, you know, protection issue is about profit before compassion.
Right.
Books should be open source. Yep. Essentially, education should be open source. There should be, you know, a free access to all for education. So an author should technically, in a perfect world, write the book. If the book's valuable and publishable and worthy of its place, then there should be a body that says, okay, here's every book that's worthy. Here's $1 million for it that comes out from a fund that the whole nation invests in. And you get to that. You don't need the bookstores. You don't need the wealthy to be able to buy it and the poor to wait for it at the libraries. Everybody should have access to it. It's the same idea with art, right? So many of the best art in the world is sitting in someone's private collection, never to see the light of day. Right. When it was never meant for that. It was meant for the world to react to it, not the one billionaire to put it in his over his hot tub or something.
For sure. And like you say, like even the books that are on the shelf that we've read in my local book club, like we did digital copies so we could all see it and we could all look at it that way. It wasn't the book on my shelf. So
you see what I mean?
Better to have the digital copy, yeah.
Right.
But No, that's interesting. I with the person who writes about sustainability, but then is flying around the country, that's clearly hypocritical, right? Like they've crossed that line where you go, okay, well now you put your well-being and your promotion, self-promotion above the mission, right? But what do you say about somebody who is publishing with a small publishing house, so there's print copies and whatnot, and they still do book tours, but they don't do it quite in that way. They say go around through, you know, regular, like maybe less toxic forms of travel to promote the ideas in the book because the ideas are what's important.
Okay. Very simple. You should be advocating for a shift of culture. So right now we have this culture where, authors make their ways into bookstores and do the signings and the readings, and they interact with their clients and with their readers, with their audience and all of those things, right? And they get speaking engagements through that, and that helps them and their causes and whatnot. Today, in a digital world where we have realized, grace to go COVID, before COVID, nobody would have dared said this. We can have this conversation. We can have the podcast, right? Before this, I would have had to show up at your studio in physically to be there to have a conversation. Otherwise, I can't talk to this guy on FaceTime and post it, because that's just wrong. Nobody would listen to it. It's illegal, essentially. Yeah. From up here, it's no, it's an X. So we did it though. COVID forced us to manage multi-billion dollar industries from our living rooms and right. home offices and all those places, right? And it forced us to have, to do our work from home. Parents and families and single people, whatever, they were sitting at home with their laptop at the office, essentially. Whereas you wouldn't dare do that. Even if you did all of your work every day, your boss would fire you at the end of the week if you didn't show up that week, even if you did everything perfectly. So today we have a change in culture. Use that. Tell your audience, look, I'm doing a live at 4 p.m. at this place, this time, whatever. Join. You can have the same report. You're not doing anything physical. You're not touching people. There's no physicality involved in your book reading or your art or anything that you need to be there in person. So, do it in a different way. So there you cut the community, you cut the travel, you cut all of these things, and it's not just your travel. People say the carbon footprint of, the author, they're not taking a charter flight anymore. They're traveling economy, or better yet, they're taking the train or the bus, or they're driving an electric car. That's fine. I grant you that. But that bookstore that you're going to be in LA, for example, is attracting 200 people to come to that bookstore. How are they coming there? Yeah, they are using some source of travel to come there and go back, right? So that itself is also creating carbon, which is on you because it's your event. So if you have that meeting at home and everybody's sitting at home, the entire carbon that you're putting out there is the internet connections from all the 200 people that are streaming with you. So
be substantially less, right?
Right. So you need to change the ways that you're interacting and make those naturalized and normal. I remember Coldplay, the lead singer from Coldplay, he had in the pandemic, he sat in his living room and had a mini concert for people, and people, tuned in, and there was millions of people who did. He was doing this as a relief for people kind of, going through the lockdowns and stuff. It was just as beautiful and amazing. Maybe not just as, but very close to amazing and very intimate feeling, because you're so close, in the video and everything. And it's so raw and kind of acoustic and beautiful to experience that. And you can do that. You don't need to have a huge live venue, tour going around the world. And it's just too much for the problems we're having today. If we didn't have these problems, and if we weren't facing extinction, and if we weren't in this situation of the future that is coming, deteriorating in the ways that we know it is, it's no longer, a myth or a conspiracy, or we know we're deteriorating at some levels. I'd say have it. It's beautiful. Get everybody together in the car. Have Woodstock. It's lovely. It's beautiful. Right. Have Live Aid, but not when Woodstock leads to death. Go to the concert, and then next morning, guillotine. No, I won't go to the concert.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and like you say, it makes me think of the Taylor Swift phenomenon that's going on right now, where when she puts on a concert in a town or a city, there's 50,000 extra people show up in that city, and you go so how big is even if you take out her own carbon footprint, her own unsustainable model. Like you say, 50,000 people traveled from however far away to come and see that show.
At that point, it becomes a question of exactly, like I said, if this is such a big factor to our immediate problems of the world, right? At that point, we start thinking, how valuable is that music? And is it music at the end? Is it art? Because, art is not destructive. one of the qualities of art is it can't be destructive. It has to be something that engages the mind. So if you are essentially destructive in your art, then you're not an artist. You know, that's one thing I always say. And you know, this isn't about Taylor Swift. I mean, people pick on her because, again, she's famous now. She's the person. But there was a Taylor Swift when Madonna was, rising through the ranks when she was in her 20s and 30s. There was a Taylor Swift when Whitney Houston was rising through her ranks, and many other people before them and after Taylor Swift. So it's not Taylor Swift. It's the system. It's the way that the system is managed for profit. You're not going to get $1 billion out of Taylor Swift without the mechanism of the motions that are going right now. You're not going to make $1 billion out of Drake, without the ways that the system works on that. So it is about profit. But if we learn to transition this art to compassion, imagine, Live Aid was a really big concert to help, in the 80s, to help AIDS and awareness and, fundraising for it and whatnot. I don't see a banner in, for example, you mentioned Taylor Swift, and Taylor Swift or many people's concerts, right bang in front of on the tickets and in front of the shows and everywhere and on the screens and everything about awareness to a cause or something that even triggers their music. A lot of these people, take rap. A lot of it is about the inner struggle, urban struggles of, major metropolitan cities in the United States and racism and, the Black community and cultures within that. And so how many of them are publicly taking their music to invest into change versus buying, whatever that the music
fancy
is about.
Fancy cars
today.
Or what have you.
The stuff that, this, because 80s rap is not today's rap.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So that was different. That's why Tupac still survives in the music till today. Right. Everybody respects that music because that music was about what touches everybody still today in their heart. Whereas, if you bring a song from today, that's talking about buying a Bugatti 30 years from now, where, things have changed and Bugatti's out and there's a new something.
People are nobody's going to care.
What is that? I cannot relate to that. But when you bring Tupac and he talks about some pain, you relate to that still 50 years later, which is why you still read some of the books that were written 1,000 years ago. Whereas you don't read something that was written in 1984, which was a bestseller about, how to be successful, the best investment. Right. And nobody reads that anymore, even though it was a bestseller, but it was only 20 years ago. But you read Stoicism that was, centuries ago.
Right.
Marcus Aurelius, centuries ago. You still read about that.
Even though he was wrong about some things, we still read Aristotle.
Exactly. I know. A lot of them were wrong about a lot of things placed in context today, but they raised the moral issues that everybody goes through and fights, right? Kant was not, Nietzsche was not even right about everything, but there is value because it triggers you to even say that. It triggers you to say, hey, they were wrong about this or that, or I want to challenge this concept there, right? So it moves you to become more moralistic or ethical in your perspective or to defend the ethics that you're trying to compose. Whereas today, it's just about the sales. It's just about how many books can we push out? How many, songs can we download from this? And that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. For sure.
And that goes to compassivis, right? That's compassivis. To shift that mentality, when you ask me about, my political view or my social view, it's shifting that mentality to use Taylor Swift as a proponent for change and betterment and making the world a better place, as opposed to using her for, clothing, for makeup, for trends, for fashion, for selling tickets for Super Bowl halftimes and things like that.
Right. Yeah. I was actually thinking we're coming up on just about 45 minutes. So it's probably a good idea to flesh out compassivist maybe a little bit more. I don't know if we got the full picture of it.
Well, compassivist. So imagine an octopus. The reason why I mentioned the octopus is the tentacles work in unison to achieve a goal. They're not independent. So just like human arms, when you try to raise a glass with two hands. You know, the two hands are working together to raise the glass in a different way than if you were trying to raise the glass in one hand. So your hands function through the brain that tells the hands what is happening and what they should do to achieve that final goal of raising the glass together. So the eight tentacles, for example, our music program, is not about just the music on its own. It's about what is the purpose of driving music so that we can include it in through the foundation to support the causes and to support the changes that we want to infrastructurally and socially, that we can advance the world to betterment. So we have the publishing house, which essentially started because I had an offer for my books with a big publishing company, and I have 13 of them now. Essentially, I said no because, one, they wanted the print mandated in there with the tour and all of those things. I said, no, I'm an advocate for stuff against this. I'm not doing this. Then they wanted to change some of the message and the expression. I said, no, this is mine. And then, you know, they want to own the rights. I said, we can't do that because I'm not taking any profit from my books. You know, Compassivis, all of its arms are not for profit. And essentially, right. You know, it's a co-op social structure that feeds all of the profit, what's called profit, into the foundation to share with the communities. So how am I going to give you the rights if the essence of this book is meant for this purpose? And you love the ideas of the book because it explains that. So you want to say, let's tell the story as a fable, but take the profits, you know? You know, so, and I can't do that. So then I started Compassivis Publishing because of that. So that's how it started. And what we do is all of our authors keep their books. So you write a book, you submit it to us. We say, we like it. We're going to publish you. We will market you. We will spend the money to do all of that. But you keep the rights of the book. You take 50%, we take 50%. The 50% that we take goes directly into the causes. So it's not profit. Okay. And your 50%, you can go buy your Ferrari with it if that's your mentality. But we hope not, but you could. It's your right to do whatever you want. But what the idea here is that, you know, we don't enslave you and we don't push you and we don't force you to sit there and try to make profit out of your book. Go out there, you know, play your social media, push it, you know, push this book out. Like, I'm not the kingpin trying to make sure that my peddlers are pushing out the drug as fast as possible for me to make the bigger chunk of the profit. So that's not the model that we're in. You know, it's a communal model. Then, you know, the art program is the same thing. So we're developing these art capsules where people go into them and enjoy them as part of the kitchen capsule, which is, I'll get to that in a moment. And if you submit your art and, you know, we put it there with whether it's digital or print, and we place it there and we have themes and people come and look at those, and we spark discussions and we spark people's, you know, meditative and ruminating thoughts about the art that's placed there, and they leave. It's not for sale. It's for the whole public to view. The donations that we raise from these capsules then get divided amongst the artists that are involved in the program, based on their capacity of involvement, whether you have 10 pieces or one piece or whatnot, so that they can continue their expressionism, as opposed to me calling them and saying, hey, you know, Joe, Mary, we really need dolphins this month. Like, you guys got to do me dolphins because, you know, that's trending and it's big. And remember that dolphin that they saved off the coast of, you know, somewhere, and they pushed it back in the water. It's really pushing dolphin sales and everything dolphin. So make dolphins, and Joe and Mary go and start painting. It's not about that. You do whatever you want. Tell us, and then we will package those into categories where we know, okay, we have 10 things that everybody's talking about. I don't know, the crucifixion, you know, so we'll have that, the Jesus, the crucifixion. Let's spark a discussion about that. How are we going to approach that? And then we create those capsules. That's one. Second one. The third one is the kitchen, where we try to educate people in a kitchen in different parts of the world, where you learn about food. In essence, you know, a lot of people know fast food's not good for you today, but you learn really about the ins and outs of food from professionals and about, you know, how you are eating in the sense of the carbon impact of it as well. So like we said earlier, you know, you could be like, oh, I'm having avocado, I'm having, you know, almonds and this and that. Well, find out how much destruction this is causing to animals as well.
Right.
And find out when you eat stuff that are out of season. So, if, you know, it's not strawberry season, but you're having strawberries, find out the impact of that, because it's not in your vicinity. It's not in your locality. It's coming from somewhere very far. Find out about the legal aspects of that, the slave labor that's going on in those farms. Where is it coming from? All those things before you eat that strawberry and think, oh, delicious, you know?
Right.
Eat local, yeah. Understand your farms, all of that. And the food is free because they're sponsored by the local community and it's vegan. So all our farms sponsor it. They provide the foods. We have celebrity local chefs who come and create the menu based on the food of the region. And so you have an event, you have, it's there for weeks and basically people interact with it. They learn about food and this education goes away with them. So the next day when they're in a supermarket aisle, they're no longer looking at that aisle in the same way as they used to before. They're not looking at even the organic section in the same way they're looking at it before. They're looking at it with a critical mind now. So, and what we do there is we, the hungry, the homeless, anybody is invited to join and in the spaces to eat and to That's be awesome. Among the people. There's no rich and poor here. There's no Michelin stars that we're getting. We're giving everybody food, and we also create food packages for animal shelters and places that are unable to provide quality food for the animals as much as we can and as long as we're there. And also teaching people about pet foods, because a lot of people at home, even the wealthy, they'll go to the pet store and buy the most expensive brand because it's the most expensive. It's got to be the best for my dog. So that's what I'm feeding my dog, not knowing that the majority of the stuff in there is poison for your pet. And the majority of the pet food companies are owned by the pharmaceutical companies who then make the medication to remedy the poison that is causing your animal to get sick. And that's Jeez. How the veterinary system works. So we do all of that through that program. Again, not for profit, all managed in that way. And everybody working in the environment are volunteers who sign up from, time ahead so that we organize the whole thing. So those are, some of the arms that essentially do. And then we have the brain of the operation, which is Label Your Carbon. And that is a movement that's spearheading the restaurant industry, the tourism, hotels, and aviation industry, and branching out into products. And basically what we're doing is we're getting a label for the carbon footprints of products so that the competition on product sales becomes more critical in the understanding of the sustainability. So if you have Pepsi and Coca-Cola and both of them have a little label and they say 8 grams of carbon, one says 8, one says 7, people are just generally, because they're looking to be the better human, are going to go and pick the You're 7.
With this, yeah.
Right. And then what's going to happen? Right. The person with the Coca-Cola is now going to say, hey, guys, why are we losing sales? The team's going to come back and say, because we're at 8 and they're at 7. They're like, okay, we need to get a 5. And they're going to spend the money there on R&D to get to 5. When they get to 5, Pepsi's going to say, God darn, okay, we need to get to 3 now. And it's going to bring it down to that minimum.
Turn their own capitalist mindset right. against them.
Exactly. So that's what Label Your Carbon is about. And, we have an app for people to be involved. And we're also in the gaming industry where we're coming out with a game soon, mobile game, and it's expanding into a bigger perspective of that to involve gaming into the world in a sense to raise awareness for environmental issues and social issues through gaming, as opposed to imagine, some of those violent games with mafias and killings and things like that, but reverse it where you rise, as you become a better human as opposed to a worse human. So you have these difficult decisions to make where you have to be like, I really want to kill this person to get this point here or whatever, but the better thing to do is to save that person there. So, okay, I do that and you get more points and it takes it from there. So those are all the arms of Compassivist, so to speak, and we have our websites, compassivistfoundation.org, the charity where our causes are up there on a monthly basis and people can go there. They can donate, they can volunteer, they can be involved. We have compassivistpublishing.com where you can submit your books, you can buy our books. And we have quarterly anthologies that come out of there. And essentially, those are meant to ignite people's thoughts every 3 months about something, about a major issue that we think people should listen to and collaborate with. And, you know, we have Compassive East, which is essentially a lot of our writings as a blog, so to speak, to ignite the thoughts. And we have Compassive East Dialogues, which is the final part. And Compassive East Dialogues is what we're doing right now. But see, in this show and in many shows, it is about the guest and the guest's views and the guest's ideology and all that. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to have a dialogue where I will sit with you, I'll sit with Corey, and Corey will tell me about anarchism. And I will say what my thoughts are about anarchism, and Corey can tell me what his thoughts are. And we can have a conversation just like we're at a coffee shop. And in that conversation, it's no longer Corey talking about anarchism and the guest taking that bit that Corey said, but it's more about, hey, there's two sides to the coin. And this is what Corey said, this is what Ali said, and it's triggering my thoughts and it's triggering my ideology. And I'm more on Corey's side. Or you know what? They're really saying the same thing. They're just calling it differently. So at the end of the day, this is good. You know, this is what I'm taking from it. So it's more of like a dialogue situation where we're bringing on different types of people from, you know, people who are trying to make change in the world, people who have made a lot of change in the world, people, everyday heroes, all sorts of mixes. It's not, again, very decentralized in that way. It's not about bringing a celebrity on so that you get ratings. It's about a show people can relate to.
That's awesome. Is there a membership or something so that people can sign up to see that stuff?
Yeah, so everything is open for people to see everything they want to see. And what we will have is once the Label Your Carbon program kicks off, we're going to have a section, a platform, where that is where the sign-up space is, the membership is. And what happens there is you sign up because you're allowed to now activate your causes through the app. And what that means is imagine a LinkedIn for activism. So Corey, you know, it has his book club. What does he do there? You know, this is what he does there. He wants to get more people involved. So he posts the time that the people are there. He posts the location and whatever, whether it's digital or whether it's physical. And now everybody can know about it in his 5 mile radius and they can join where they couldn't have before, because not everybody would have known Corey's Instagram, even if he posted it there. But on this platform where you have, you know, 100 million people joined, it's very easy, kind of like Uber, to find a car, right? Because there's so many drivers and so many people looking for a car all around the world. So it becomes easy to locate. And so if you create that model where activism is as easy to locate as a car that'll take you from A to B, then you can be the person who takes, you know, goes A to B to reach that cause and to escalate that cause into, you know, the right space that it should be, because that's what you're involved in. So that's where the membership comes. And, you know, it's free, but the reason we have it set up that way is to have more accountability on the people posting stuff and what causes they're raising and, you know, being able make sure that it's ethical in a sense, because we don't want to create a platform where a Nazi comes and says, hey, we're having, you know, a pro-Nazi movement here. And then everybody within a 5 mile radius and more show up there. So that's the reason for the membership, essentially a gatekeeping policy.
Fair enough. So I guess, we kind of already told people where they can find you, but I guess we better just to make sure, what is the website? Where can people find Compassive East?
The easiest is what you just said, compassiveeast.com. So it's CompassiveEast.com. That's the starting point. You can start there, browse your way through that. You'll find links and you'll find, you know, ways to get around into the other, websites and just go down that rabbit hole and, you know, find the space where you fit in essentially and stay there.
Right on. Is there, are you guys on a social media of any kind?
Yeah. We're on social media. So we're on all of the major ones and you know, it's at Compassive East obviously. And that's what it is. And it was easy to get because it was a new word. Nobody had thought about it. So, you know, there was no problems there. I didn't have to call someone and beg. that's easy. So we're there. And again, you know, we do post some of our beliefs, our thoughts, some issues and stuff, but it's not, like I said, you know, earlier, Compassivista is about you. It's about Corey. It's not about following. So it's about taking the mindset of I need to find ways to switch from my, you know, capitalist mindset, not in the social capitalist order system, but in the, you know, the opportunism that's in our heads that we always look for profit in something. I need to get that out and I need to replace it with compassion. So I need to replace it with mindfulness. I need to, you know, to become Buddha in a sense, you know, or Jesus, to change myself into those people. Or, right. You know, even more recently, you know, you look at Rosa Parks, for example, Gandhi, you know, people who have made change that doesn't necessarily benefit them, but it benefits the world, right?
Right.
And for many of them, it didn't. I mean, Martin Luther King caught a bullet benefiting USA. Yep. But, you know, I don't see as much praise for him as some other people who, you know, scored a winning goal in finals or something. So, those are the things that need to be, that Compassivista is about. So it's about you. You can follow us, you can share with us, you can interact with us, you can engage with us, you can be part of our programs, you can join all of our programs, you know, and see where they're happening, what's going on and all of that. That's great. Please show up, please interact. But at the end of the day, it's about you going inside here, inside yourself, you know, inside your heart, inside your mind, and making the difference. And that's how you kind of grow into Compassivista.
Right on. So I guess, thank you very much for your time today. And it was a very great conversation.
Thank you very much. It was awesome.
All right. That's all, folks. Thanks for watching and or listening. Remember to share this show with your friends and on the social media site that you use the most. Thank you to everyone who supports this show on Patreon. I really appreciate it, and it helps me keep the internet and the power on. Thanks to my top patrons, Some Random Geek, Damian Marie at Hope, Justin Clark, Christopher Taylor, Dan F. Smith, and Lisa Glass. If you want to contribute, you can do that at patreon.com/skepticalleftist, or you can send a one-time donation to me at buymeacoffee.com/skepticallefty. If you can't contribute financially, then a like on YouTube or a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or one of the podcast review sites like Podchaser would be great. If you want to find more from me, then make sure to check out the show notes for links to all my stuff, or check out my website, skepticalleftist.com. That's where you can find all of my social media spaces and communities. Or you can also email me at mindofaskepticalleftist@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening or watching. Make sure to leave a comment on the video or on my website. Join your local org, print off some posters or pamphlets, and spread the propaganda.
And we do something about explaining that, explaining where the government of the self, the rule of the self, starts with compassion. And you can elaborate, because you will have all of, you know, the education behind that to kind of express that mentality. And we can merge it with the idea of why the state systems of efficiency are essentially, you know, draconian systems that are dangerous to emotion, to care, to compassion, for sure, to anything that's human. And, you know, maybe people start thinking about that a little bit, thinking about, you know, when you're working in that model, because capitalism today is like that.